The clothes you're wearing are still made by hand, hands often working in unsafe conditions for pennies.
For instance, in Bangladesh, at the time of the Rana Plaza incident, it was $36 a month.
Bringing manufacturing back to the States, plus trading fashion for activism and an unsung founder of the labor movement. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. One year ago, more than 1,000 people died when a factory building in Bangladesh collapsed. Most of them were women and children. Another 2,500 people were hurt. They were garment workers, ordered back to work after cracks were discovered in the building. A year after the Rana Plaza disaster, the momentum is building to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. and create a more transparent garment industry worldwide. Bob Bland is CEO of Manufacture New York, and she's created a model that makes use of cooperative space and equipment, as well as access to marketing expertise.
Manufacture New York is a fashion incubator and vertically integrated production facility in New York City, and we are dedicated to bringing back domestic manufacturing to the United States and then also supporting local supply chains throughout the world that are sustainable and ethical and that just make sense for the communities around them.
And we are in a very different time from when manufacturers had huge plants in the United States and people had jobs in those plants. Obviously, you have to redesign the entire manufacturing industry. What is it that you have in mind to make it work here?
It starts with a basic understanding of what the supply chain is for fashion and where we are now. Many global companies, oftentimes they don't even know it, but the factory that they've actually selected to make their product uses subcontractors that are oftentimes not operating within the guidelines of their governments, or in developing countries, oftentimes there just aren't enough rules and restrictions the way there is here in the United States.
And Bob, just how common is it that garments are made overseas now? Is it the vast majority of what we see in stores?
It's over 98% of what Americans wear right now are made overseas.
And is that, companies say, is that because of the cost of labor?
Labor costs are one of the primary drivers of what I like to call the race to the bottom, where what we're experiencing is that companies who are engaged in creating cheap throwaway fashion, they're basically showing consumers that it just makes sense to get the lowest price possible, regardless of the quality of the make. And so they continue to pursue countries where there are lower and lower and lower wages. That often comes with huge human costs when it comes to women and children and people who don't have resources, who are just looking to survive, who end up making these garments, but in very unsafe conditions, and often their compensation is extremely low. For instance, in Bangladesh, at the time of the Rana Plaza incident, it was $36 a month. Was what these people were making.
So what are you proposing as an alternative? How can you change the way business is done in the garment industry?
I think the customer themselves is a huge part of this conversation. First, just even educating them in how their clothes are made and why, for instance, a $5 t-shirt is just not feasible to be done ethically. It's just not possible with the textile production itself, the actual making of the apparel, because I think it really starts with people knowing that every single garment that they wear is still primarily made by hand. So there is a person at a machine who is sewing that garment. Their automation has never extended very far in the garment industry aside from automated cutting and digital pattern making and automated screen printing, the actual make of garments is done by people. So you'll have 20 or 30 hands touching just a simple t-shirt. The ultimate amount of money that a manufacturer makes off of a $5 t-shirt might only be 50 cents or a dollar. So can you imagine what the workers who are making that t-shirt make? It must be only pennies.
So what is the existing manufacturer New York model? You've actually got physical plants. What happens there?
What we do is we have two arms. We have a fashion incubator, and the idea around that is that this generation of fashion designers are already so much more interested in sustainability and in transparent supply chains than ever before. So we want to make sure that they have the resources and skills that they need to be able to create robust, healthy lines. So we offer them product development services, business development services, and then shared space and community so that they can work together to create these beautiful lines and really have a launch pad to make this happen. Because oftentimes what we see is 90% of designers who start a line, it fails within the first 2 years. Typically, because there's not much funding behind it, but also because they just there's a lot of resources that not every single designer who wants to make a line has to buy a sewing machine. We can share those resources. So it's really part of a collaborative economy when it comes to the incubator portion of what we do. Now, to vertically integrate the supply chain, what we also offer is product development services. So we actually do in-house pattern development and sampling for designers and also small lines that are interested in reshoring, or which means bringing their product back from overseas to America, and then also people who are just starting their lines but don't necessarily know how to do all the development there themselves. So we offer them all those services. Now, what we also offer is business development services, because oftentimes what we find is designers and people who are starting their own lines, these small brands, haven't done an adequate amount of business development in terms of creating a business plan, creating a fiscal model for them, a revenue model that's sustainable, that's actually going to pay them for what they're doing, and then also securing investment, because since fashion is a very expensive business in terms of overhead, because you're creating an actual product, it's very important to get some outside investment if you're not already independently wealthy. So we help with that as well. In 2014, right now, we're working on a Brooklyn manufacturing center that will bring together 25 to 30 manufacturers all in one space in Sunset Park called Liberty View Industrial Plaza.
As a consumer, when I see a label that says something is made in the USA, is it really?
We certainly have better regulations than many other countries. For instance, when I was and internationally, this was a problem where I was actually in a factory in China one time overseeing production where some garments that had actually been made in either Macau or Vietnam, I honestly will never know which country they were made, had been boated over to our factory, and they were simply relabeling them made in China in the factory and then shipping them out. And that's, obviously that's an ethical violation, but relabeling happens quite often overseas for a variety of reasons, mostly cost-driven. And it really, like I said before, it needs to be more transparent.
And so many businesses have changed hugely because of computers or simply changing times. The music industry has changed. The book industry has changed. Has the fashion industry also changed drastically in the past, say, 20, 25 years?
Not really. I think that it's actually quite interesting that what one element of the Web 2.0 and social media revolution has been that the primary changes in fashion have come to our actual retail models and how we do our selling. That's the number one way that the internet has played a part, is that pre-selling, which means when a designer has a collection, they will actually show it online and allow people to pre-order pieces as opposed to just having to produce the pieces and then just hope that their guesses were right in terms of what will be popular. And then also the direct-to-consumer model, which can add a lot of exciting options in terms of customization of your garments. All of that can be done online and for much better margins than especially small designers typically experience. What we're seeing is that wholesale fashion, where there's a middleman that is taking a cut before it's distributed at the retail level, is diminishing quickly. And as a result of that, that's making a lot of new emerging designers available to the public much faster. So it's really an exciting time to be in retail fashion. In terms of the actual manufacturing of clothes, we have machines that were from the early 1900s and electrified in the 40s, and they work just as well as some of the newer machines. So, you know, it's one of those things where the artisanal quality of making clothes is still just as important now as it was 50 years ago. So it's a very good business to be in right now as a designer. And then also I would encourage for women to consider manufacturing and product development as a potential career path, especially young people of all types in our country should look at manufacturing for the future, because there is an American manufacturing resurgence happening right now, and typically those types of jobs make 20 to 30% more than service or retail jobs of the same caliber. So we are currently creating workforce development training programs here in New York City to teach an entire new generation of people how to make clothes and jewelry and other goods again on an industrial level. And so I think that that's going to be the source of thousands of new jobs in the next 5 years here in America.
Bob Bland is CEO of Manufacture New York. Coming up, a forgotten labor activist who inspired Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1296. Sweatshops were once common in the U.S. It was the labor movement that ended child labor in this country and helped create living wages in safer conditions. Gilles Malkin has a profile of one labor activist whose name isn't a household word, Lucy Parsons, a woman who inspired a nonviolent movement that spread around the world and whose papers were confiscated and hidden by our government.
Imagine, if you will, a major American city suddenly rocked by the first major labor strike in American history, with outright murder and mayhem occurring between strikers and police, followed by completely prejudiced and criminally concocted court proceedings against striker defendants who were convicted and executed or jailed for life. Now fast forward 118 years and witness that same city naming a park in honor of one of the striker's heroes. The city was Chicago, the event was the Haymarket Riot, and the honoree was an incredibly courageous woman named Lucy Parsons. Lucy Eldine Gonzalez was of African American, Native American, and Mexican descent. She was born into slavery in Texas in 1853, and eventually was run out of that state for marrying Albert Parsons, a white man, which was illegal. They moved to Chicago and became involved with the struggle against the oppression of workers and fought for the changes to American labor laws that make working tolerable today, but which so many of us take for granted. In order to become as wealthy as possible, The industrial bosses were working their employees extremely long hours every day for very little pay and housing them in terribly poor and dangerous quarters. The contract labor law of 1864 had permitted them to bring in huge numbers of immigrants to be put to work. So all wages were very low, and there were no laws protecting children from being forced to work just as long and as dangerously as their parents. Lucy believed that it's possible to have a world where justice is virtually guaranteed because everyone's interests are the same. She also believed that the way to strike effectively was not to only go out and pound the streets, but to take over the factory in which workers were being abused and have them run it themselves. That year, anger was sizzling on a national scale concerning poverty wages. On May 1st, 1886, 350,000 American workers went on strike all over the U.S., demanding the same pay they were getting, but for an 8-hour work day. They were up against not only the industrialists, but all the combined power of the institutions and authorities who could perform in one way or another in favor of the industrialists and who were ready and willing to do so, the courts, the politicos, the media, the police, and the churches. In Chicago alone, 40,000 workers went on strike. 2 days later, at a peaceful gathering of unarmed workers, police suddenly appeared and fired into their ranks, killing and wounding many. No one knows who then threw a bomb into the police ranks, which also killed and wounded many. The authorities simply gathered up the labor leaders and put them on trial. Lucy Parsons was not among the defendants, since that might generate some sympathy for the accused, but her husband Albert was. He and two others were executed, and the others convicted to imprisonment, all on the basis of circumstantial evidence. Despite her personal loss and the suffering of so many workers, and the knowledge that change usually happens violently, Lucy always knew that war was a tool of the rich to be used for setting people against each other for their own ends. She came to advocate for nonviolence, a new concept, and her vision eventually inspired others such as Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and other leaders of so many subsequent civil rights movements. In 1905, at the formation of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, Lucy Parsons committed herself to that organization as she thought it offered the best possibilities for achieving the changes she believed in. Lucy Parsons contributed to the assistance of Angelo Herndon, an Afro-American labor organizer who was imprisoned in Georgia in 1932 and whose conviction was overturned in 1937. She became involved in the effort to get justice for the Scottsboro Boys, a group of young African-American youths who'd been falsely accused of raping two white women. The truth never did prevail, and only in 2013 did the Alabama Parole Board declare the case, quote, a miscarriage of justice that eventually produced the end of all white juries in the South, unquote. When she died in a house fire in 1942, her personal papers and library were seized by the police and never returned. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, actor, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. Finally, the story of Felicity Flick Finlayson, an up-and-coming fashion designer who left the world of design and moved to a remote island in Borneo. Now she devotes her life to marine conservation. Emily Richmond reports from Pom Pom Island in Malaysian Borneo.
This is the sound Felicity, aka Flick Finlayson, wakes up to every morning. It's the sound of life on the remote Pom Pom Island in Malaysian Borneo.
It's a really small island. You can walk around it in about 40 minutes at a leisurely pace.
When she arrived here 2 years ago, she had no idea that she'd be staying on for so long. It was meant to be a holiday, just a break from the rush of life in Melbourne and a sabbatical from her work as a fashion designer.
I made most of the clothes myself, organized a few fashion shows, and then I had a big lifestyle change and broke up with a long-term partner and thought, you know, I just want to get out of Melbourne for a bit and I might as well go do something I'm passionate about.
Flick's passion was for science, but she was never really the academic type.
I didn't actually pass year 11. Uh-huh. I got like halfway through, so no, I haven't got a lot of education.
What she lacked in training, she made up for with passion and enthusiasm. Professor Steve Oakley, who runs the Environmental Research Center on Pom Pom Island, took note and invited her to stay on to pursue an internship. 10 months after she arrived for a short holiday, she was still living on the island, but now as staff, leading the team's dives and coral restoration projects, which is what the group is gearing up for the day I visit.
Yeah, so basically we usually do, for the divers, we usually do 2 work dives a day, and that's 5 days a week. We do soft coral collection and hard coral collection, and then we transplant them to either areas that we think are more suitable or to our artificial reefs themselves.
The group is working to rebuild decades of underwater destruction, mostly caused by the widespread practice of dynamite fishing. We all suit up and head to a site on the north coast of the island. We dive in, and what we see is shocking. A seafloor that resembles a war zone. It's just all rubble. Back on land, Professor Steve Oakley explains how they go about rebuilding coral.
We use little fragments. We collect the fragments from bomb fishing sites.
He's holding up a tiny tip of coral. It's about as long as your index finger.
And we just collect them all together, put them in cement, much the same way as you put a plant into soil and fertilizer, and they grow.
He's now holding a block of cement about the size of a small house plant. The coral planted in it has already grown enough that it's now ready to be planted permanently.
I learn so much from Steve every day, just from, you know, I can ask him anything, it's amazing. I can be like, so what does this fish eat and why is this relevant? I just get the answers.
As of late, what she's been learning is that things don't always go according to plan.
Especially with science, it's a lot of trial and error. So sometimes you do things hoping that it's going to be amazing and it doesn't work. And that's just part of it. But yeah, so those days you're a bit like, ah, for goodness sakes. Or, you know, because you're always working with the weather. Sometimes you'll collect coral and you'll drop it down. 5 minutes later, the whole basket's gone. You're like, no, it's such a nightmare. But I mean, it happens with the ocean sometimes.
But by far the worst thing Flix had to deal with was the day that things went horribly, unimaginably wrong. It was the day she nearly lost her life.
So I was standing next to the boat in like waist-deep water. And one of our interns was starting the boat, I mean, as you do on every day. And there was just a malfunction, unfortunately, with the engine, and it kicked itself into gear. But yeah, I mean, it just sort of sucked me under, and then the propeller went over the back of my leg. When I popped up, I felt the back of my leg and was just like, oh my goodness, it's all gone. And then, like, I got to the beach and laid there, and I was like, okay, well, this is it. And I was just waiting, thinking, like, I know there's some really main arteries there.
Miles from land and then still hours more away from the nearest hospital, it was a brush with death that could have easily ended tragically. Fortunately for Flick, her team's quick action saved not only her life, but her leg as well. And it was a mark of the camaraderie that keeps drawing her back.
If you had have asked me on the way to Semporna, with like sandy towels wrapped around my leg, not sure what was going to happen, like I thought I was going to lose it for sure, if I would come back and dive, I would have said yes. Yeah, the whole time thinking, when can I get back? When can I get back in the water? I just kept asking them, when can I swim? You can't swim yet. So like, yeah, I mean, there wasn't a second where I didn't want to come back.
Today, Flick is back, with a conservation center largely running on the fuel of her energy. Around the year, visitors flock to the Environmental Center on Pom Pom Island to be a part of the change, to help rebuild these fragile ecosystems. Emily Richmond for DW in Borneo.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. This week's show is number 1296. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.